Hello, today is Monday. It is the 21st of September, and it is time to read from the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I will be reading to you today stories of local interest, statewide, area, and national interest from the Sioux City Journal. We'll start with the weather, go to the mini editorial, and then begin with our front page stories and continue on throughout the paper, throughout the hour. So sit back, relax, and enjoy hearing about what's going on in the world of Siouxland. First of all, Siouxland 5-day forecast. Today, mostly sunny, a little bit of wind, high of 81. Tonight, mainly clear, low of 58. Tomorrow, Tuesday, partly sunny and very warm, high of 84, low 57. On Wednesday, breezy in the morning with periods of sun, high of 83. Low of 56, and then the remaining days of the week, Thursday and Friday, high of 84 and 89, mostly sunny with a little bit of breeze. So, should be another mild to warm week ahead. Okay, let's turn now to the mini editorial, which today is written by Steve Bannys, B-A-N-Y-S, of Sioux City. And Steve says, President Trump's revised pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the divided states of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, quite divisible with liberty and justice for some. This is the opinion of Steve Bannys of Sioux City. All right, let's move now to front page stories. Top headline, Biden don't rush nomination. The Democratic candidate makes televised plea to Grassley and to Romney. Joe Biden on Sunday slammed President Donald Trump and leading Senate Republicans for trying to jam through a replacement for the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and urged more senators to stand with a pair of GOP colleagues who oppose the election season rush. The extraordinary televised plea from the Democratic presidential candidate to Republican senators reflected the ferocious maneuvering that has followed Ginsburg's death at age 87 on Friday. Her passing upended a campaign that had until then focused on Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, the nation's economic collapse and racial unrest that has stoked protests in U.S. cities. Trump has said he intends within days to name a woman to succeed the liberal icon, and Senate Majority Mitch McConnell was moving toward the first hearings this week. Just hours before Biden spoke, a second Republican senator, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, joined Senator Susan Collins of Maine in opposing efforts to fill Ginsburg's seat before the next president is elected. It takes four Republicans to break ranks to keep Trump's nominee off the court. Attention quickly focused on Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, who voted to convict Trump on one count of impeachment, and Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, a former chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Biden acknowledged that those Republicans and others like them were his target audience when he warned that Trump's plan was an abuse of power. Uphold your constitutional duty and your conscience, said Biden, speaking in Battleground, Pennsylvania. Let the people speak, cool the flames that have engulfed our country. There was little chance of calm overtaking the historic campaign as early voting progressed and the death toll from the virus reached 200,000 Americans. Just before Murkowski joined Collins, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi referred to the House having options. She did not name to stall or prevent the Senate from confirming Ginsburg's successor to the lifetime job. We have arrows in our quiver that I'm not about to discuss right now, Pelosi said, that she said on ABC's This Week. The House has no formal role in the confirmation of Supreme Court justices, but Pelosi would not rule out a new round of impeachment proceedings that might divert the Senate's attention, though that route seemed unlikely. Meanwhile, Murkowski raised by one the number of Republicans opposing a rush to confirmation. For weeks, I have stated that I would not support taking up a potential nomination as the presidential election neared. Sadly, that was then. A hypothetical is now a reality, but my position has not changed. Collins, meanwhile, said the next president should name Ginsburg's replacement. Republicans hold a 53-47 edge in the Senate. If there were a 50-50 tie, it could be broken by Vice President Mike Pence. There's another potential wrinkle. Because Arizona's Senate race is a special election, that seat could be filled as early as November 30th, which would narrow the window for McConnell if Democratic Mark Kelly wins. Trump has said he is obligated to act as soon as possible and had at least two women in mind for the seat. Most Republicans concurred on the need for speed, and one named a practical reason. The 9-member court, argued Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, must be full if called upon to decide the outcome of a disputed presidential election. But Biden and other Democrats said voters should choose the next president, who should pick Ginsburg's successor. Health care, abortion rights, and religious freedom are on the line, they said. Biden, who has run on uniting the country after Trump's divisive tenure and imparting a sense of comfort to despairing Americans, warned against more upheaval. The last thing we need is a constitutional crisis that plunges us deeper into the abyss and deeper into darkness, he said. He acknowledged that if Trump wins, his pick should be approved. But he added, if I win this election, President Trump's nominee should be withdrawn, and as the new president, I should be the one to nominate Justice Ginsburg's successor. Nonetheless, the process for replacing her moved swiftly ahead. On a call with McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, late Saturday, Trump mentioned two federal appeal court judges, Amy Coney Barrett and Barbara Lagoa. According to a person familiar with the private conversation, who was not authorized to publicly discuss the call and spoke on condition of anonymity. To the chance of fill that seat, Trump told supporters at an event Saturday night in North Carolina that he would nominate a woman as soon as this week. We win an election and those are the consequences, said Trump, who then seemed to signal that he'd be willing to accept a vote on his nominee during the lame duck period after the election. We have a lot of time. We have plenty of time. We're talking about January 20th, when the next president is inaugurated. Okay, we're going to move back to other front page news. Let's see if we have some local news. There is a picture of a large vehicle shown in this photo has been dubbed the Yumvee, which is the Storm Lake Police Department announced Thursday will be used for community outreach to dole out sweet treats. It's a big Humvee with the Storm Lake Police logo, and they're calling it the Yumvee, vehicle serving as police outreach tool. Call it a Funvee or more correctly a Yumvee. The large vehicle in the Storm Lake Police Department fleet has been changed up to make connections with people in the town that's the seat of Buena Vista County. Assistant Chief Patrick Dykeman said the department is excited to have taken the Humvee that the department already had and making it into more of a community outreach vehicle. A summer grant from the Tyson Foods plant in Storm Lake provided money that was used to reconfigure a military surplus Humvee utility vehicle, which is now dubbed the Yumvee. The Humvee was painted black and white and equipped with an ice cream freezer so that officers can patrol neighborhoods and give away free ice cream. He said the department had success in the past making community connections by handing out specialty ice cream treats such as Klondike bars and Bomb Pops on hot summer days. The challenge has always been keeping frozen items from melting. The Yumvee's freezer has been a game changer. Police Chief Chris Cole on Saturday said handing out cold treats and other items such as sports equipment dates back several years. If we see people out, we'll stop. It's a great conversation starter. Everyone likes ice cream. He said the vehicle can be converted back to more traditional police use when needed, since the Yumvee logos and freezer are removable. It isn't solely a dedicated ice cream truck, said Cole. While summer is winding down, the chief pointed to some more uses of the Yumvee ahead, when a few days with high temperature forecasts to be above 80 degrees. We'll try to get a few more weeks out of it. The weather looks good this week, he said. Next summer, with the presumption that the coronavirus community spread will not impact so many activities, he said 2021 will be the first full summer of the Yumvee use. Cole gave a caveat. He says the long reach of the virus, hopefully. Other front page news. Woodbury County positivity rate now over 15%. 8 Siouxland counties among Iowa's top 10. In Sioux City, as of Sunday evening, Woodbury County had a 14-day COVID-19 positivity rate of 15.2%, up from 14.9% that was reported the day before. That means that Woodbury County has exceeded the 15% positivity rate that Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds set to allow schools to move to online classes. Currently, there's no indication that school districts in the county will follow suit. The top 5 14-day positivity rates in Iowa counties Sunday evening were all in Siouxland. Sioux County had a 30% rate, followed by Lyon County at 22.7%, Osceola 22.3%, Crawford County at 21.4%, and Plymouth County 19.8%. Sac and Ida counties, along with Woodbury, also had rates above 15%. The only other counties in Iowa with rates above 15% threshold were Winnebago and Henry. Overall, there had been just shy of 5,000 cases of COVID-19 in Woodbury County as of Sunday evening, with 3,919 people who have recovered and 61 deaths. Siouxland District Health Department reported that it added 51 more positive cases of the novel coronavirus. On Sunday, this new number of cases, compiled over a 24-hour period, comes after the health department reported 100 new cases on Saturday. Since Woodbury County continues to see significant increase in the number of COVID-19 cases recently, the Siouxland District Health Department reminds residents that it is extremely important that everyone do their part to prevent the spread by staying home when sick, even if only mildly ill, practicing physical distancing, wearing masks in public, and washing hands frequently. As of Sunday evening, the Iowa Department of Public Health reported 80,188 total cases since the pandemic began statewide. There have been 1,265 deaths attributed to the coronavirus. The South Dakota Department of Health reported 252 new cases of COVID on Sunday. There have been 18,696 people with the virus and 16,550 recoveries. So far, 202 South Dakotans have died. The Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services reported 41,000 confirmed cases with 442 deaths. Statewide, 426,000 Nebraskans have been tested. All righty, we're going to go back to other front page news. Disasters disrupt census. Bureau contending with fires and hurricanes in Orlando. Already burdened by the coronavirus pandemic and a tightened deadline, the Census Bureau must now contend with several natural disasters, such as wildfires and hurricanes, disrupting the final weeks of the nation's once-a-decade headcount. The fires on the West Coast forced tens of thousands of people to flee their homes in California and Oregon before they could be counted, and tens of thousands of others were uncounted in the Louisiana communities hit hard last month by Hurricane Laura. Nearly 250,000 more households were unaccounted in areas affected this week by Hurricane Sally. The disasters added to the already laborious task of counting of every U.S. resident and increased the risk that the effort will miss people in some parts of the country. I can't project if Mother Nature's going to let us finish, but we're going to do the best we can, said Al Fontenot, Associate Director of the Census Bureau, who has repeatedly said the Bureau is on target to complete the count at the end of the month. The disasters make it a challenge or impossible for census takers to visit households who have yet to have answered the census information and the questionnaires. The time is running out, with just 2 weeks left until the census is scheduled to end on September 30th. In major cities in California and Oregon, smoke from nearby wildfires poses a health risk for census takers as they knock on doors. It's really smoky and no one wants to open their doors because of the hazardous air. I gave up yesterday and don't plan to go out today unless it improves, a San Francisco census taker said, who spoke on the condition of anonymity out of fear that she could lose her job. Officials in San Jose are encouraging residents to respond to census questions online or over the phone or mail. Frankly, it's not safe to be outside for more than a little bit, said San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo. So yes, it will affect us. We're going to hustle every other way we possibly can. If there's an undercount, states affected by the disasters could be shortchanged, while some $1.5 trillion of federal spending is distributed annually to pay for roads, schools, health care, and other programs. Since the census also determines how many congressional seats each state gets, states such as California that are on the verge of losing a seat because of declining population could see that political power diluted. Republican Representative Jimmy Gomez, a Democrat from Los Angeles, said the recent disasters are another reason the deadline for ending the census should be extended by a month. Because of the pandemic, the Census Bureau pushed back the deadline for finishing the count from the end of July to the end of October. Then the agency announced last month that the deadline would be changed to the end of September after the Republican-controlled Senate failed to pass a Census Bureau request for more time to turn in numbers used for redrawing congressional districts. Some Democrats and activists believe the expedited schedule is politically motivated. A coalition of cities and civil rights groups are suing in federal courts in San Jose, seeking an extra month. We know the shorter the time frame, the more risk there is to an accurate count, and the more problems can arise. This is not usually the time of the year that the Census Bureau is doing the counting. The San Jose lawsuit contends that the sped-up timetable will cause Latinos, Asian Americans, and immigrants to be overlooked. Government attorneys say the Census Bureau will not have enough time to process the data to meet an end-of-the-year deadline if the count does not finish by the end of September. If you had a longer period, you'd expect some people to return home, and you could concentrate on those geographies, said Thomas Salons, president and general counsel of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, which is seeking extra time in another lawsuit in Maryland. Census takers headed to evacuation centers to complete the count, and residents will be counted according to where they were on April 1st. In areas that there is such extreme danger, such as parts of Oregon, census field offices had to close for several days and home visits were suspended. In some places where census takers cannot go, they're trying to reach households by phone, according to the Census Bureau officials. Fontenot said in court papers in the Maryland case that the natural disasters and other disruptions pose significant risks to finishing the count in all states by the deadline. The Census Bureau estimated there were 248,000 unaccounted households affected by Hurricane Sally in Alabama and Florida, 34,000 uncounted households affected by Hurricane Laura in Louisiana, and close to 80,000 unaccounted households in California affected by wildfires, and 17,500 Oregon households also threatened by the flames. The disasters worry the federal judge in the San Jose lawsuit, who is considering whether to extend the count by a month. During a recent hearing, Judge Lucy Caw said some workers at her courthouse have been evacuated and that their neighborhoods were destroyed. Here we've been told not to go outside for 28 days because of unsafe air. How are you doing 6 visits to households when people can't even go outside? How are we going to count in this reality for us? I think that's it for our front page stories for today. Let's go on inside the paper, looking at the SiouxCityJournal.com. Extra, extra. Enjoy dozens of extra photos from the Siouxland football games with our online photo galleries. They're chock full of images that didn't make it into print. There's a virtual tour. Get a look inside stately homes currently or recently owned by celebrities spanning entertainment, sports, and business with a special gallery on our website. Our weekly recipes email delivers simple yet innovative meal ideas for this week straight in your inbox each Sunday afternoon. Sign up on our website. In Top Talker, it says outlook not improving for U.S. movie theaters. About 3/4 of the country's movie theaters are open, but Americans are not going back in significant numbers in the COVID era, even with new films coming into the marketplace weekly. The biggest movies continue to limp along. According to studio estimates Sunday, Warner Brothers' Tenet earned $4.7 million in its third weekend from 2,900 locations. Disney's movie called The New Mutants added $1.6 million in the fourth weekend. Unhinged brought in $1.3 million, and Sony's rom-com The Broken Hearts Gallery picked up an additional $800,000 in its second frame. The newcomers are not faring any better. The faith-based Infidel, which stars Jimmy Cavazel, did the best with $1.5 million from 1,700 theaters. Looks like movies are having a difficult time. Des Moines says no to governor's demand for classroom return. Students in Iowa's largest school system in Des Moines are facing the possibility that this most unusual school year could stretch into next summer, and the district could be hit with crippling bills because of a dispute with the governor over the safety of returning to classrooms during the coronavirus pandemic. Des Moines schools officials have repeatedly refused to abide by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' order requiring the state's 327 school districts to hold at least half of their classes in person rather than online. For Des Moines, it's a question of trying to keep its more than 33,000 students and 5,000 staffers from contracting the disease. But after the school board last week again voted to violate Reynolds' order, the governor called the action unacceptable and began the process for punishing the district. Reynolds has dismissed Des Moines officials' concerns, noting that nearly all other Iowa districts have reopened their classrooms despite some virus outbreaks and the occasional need to quarantine students, saying that where there's a will, there's a way. School districts across the country have struggled with the decision of whether to return to the classrooms despite the risk of coronavirus infections or shift to online learning. And the choice is especially stark for Iowa's capital city. Des Moines has had one of the nation's highest rates of people testing positive for COVID-19, and school board members ask how it would be possible to enforce social distancing rules in their crowded classrooms and packed school buses. The school board delayed the start of school by a week as the district sought a court injunction to block the governor's orders, arguing that she had overstepped her boundaries and her authority. The judge initially sided with the governor, but the district proceeded with its plan to distribute thousands of laptops to students and launched a completely online course offering on September 8. District officials have said they're deeply troubled to be out of compliance with state standards, but they believe the governor has put them in a no-win situation by ordering students to spend at least half their time in the classroom. Reynolds' order does not allow waivers, allowing online-only instruction, but only for districts where more than 15% of people test positive for the virus, which is triple the 5% positivity rate that the CDC and other health experts say would be appropriate for resuming in-person classes. The district notes that 31% of its staff members have health concerns that have put them at higher risk from COVID-19, and 10% are older than age 60. If forced to resume classes, officials contend many teachers and bus drivers would quit rather than risk being infected by the virus. The positivity rate in Polk County, where most of Des Moines is located, reached 12% earlier in September, but now dropped to about 7%. Except for our State Department of Public Health, every other health expert we talk to does not understand why we're even having to have this fight. Because they recognize it isn't safe for us to reopen our schools, said Des Moines Superintendent Tom Ahart. It feels like operating in an alternate reality. If they find the district is out of compliance, state officials could take a variety of actions, including requiring the district to keep students in classes until the end of June, nearly a month later than usual. A district official said each additional day would cost $1.5 million, draining the district's reserve within days. District officials have assured students that they will get credit for the online classes they're taking. But parent Jason Hahn told school board members at a recent online meeting that he was worried they could be wrong, since the district lost the first round of its lawsuit. The longer the district continues with only online learning, the deeper the financial risk. The end result of continuing to operate without an approved plan will likely be a district that loses accreditation and that is bankrupt. This scenario would be catastrophic for the community, the district, and the students. Reynolds is the only Midwest governor to issue a statewide order requiring in-person instruction, while all other states in the region leave decisions to local school districts. Reynolds, a strong supporter of Donald Trump, who has demanded on Twitter that schools must open in the fall, also has refused to issue a statewide mask requirement and told at least 10 cities that they can't enforce local mandates because they would exceed her actions. Although Des Moines lawsuit has not been resolved, a judge ruled that the state has power over the school districts, even if its rationale is based on flawed coronavirus benchmarks. In a separate lawsuit, another judge sided with the state and against Iowa City schools and a teachers' union, saying the governor has broad emergency powers that local school boards do not have. The union, the Iowa State Education Association, opposes the governor's action, but a teacher walkout is unlikely because state law prohibits public employees from striking. The state first issued its requirements to school districts in July. At a news conference Wednesday, the governor expressed exasperation at what she called Des Moines' slow walk to compliance. Asked how the state would respond, Education Department Director Ann Lebo would not be specific, but said the agency would begin a process to punish the district for not complying. We're very hopeful to work with the district to find a solution, said Lebo. At this point, it seems they are well into a plan that is out of compliance and will continue to do so. So we have to initiate that process on our own and on our end. The school board will discuss the issue again Monday night and will consider a plan still being developed that would include a part-time return to classrooms. Middle school Spanish teacher Trisha Peckish, who has children in the district, says it's hard to see how the district and state will resolve the dispute. It's true that students would learn better if they were in the classroom, but Des Moines is right to worry about the safety of students and staff. Everyone is in such a hard position. Every time you come up with a solution that could work, there's a roadblock. Okay, continuing on to other briefs. One man killed in crash near Vermilion. One man died early Sunday morning in a one-vehicle crash north of Vermilion. According to South Dakota Highway Patrol, a 1999 Grand Jeep Cherokee was southbound on the State Highway 19 when the driver lost control and entered the east ditch. The 27-year-old driver, who was not wearing a seatbelt, was thrown from the vehicle, pronounced dead on the scene of the accident. The name of the person involved is not being released at this time. In other news, the State Patrol is investigating a two-vehicle crash in rural Plymouth County, Iowa. The Iowa State Patrol said it is investigating a two-vehicle accident that occurred around 2:18 p.m. Sunday afternoon near the intersection of K-22 and C-60. In a news release, the Iowa State Patrol said no additional information is available at this time.
The Iowa State Patrol was assisted by the Plymouth County Sheriff's deputies, the Hinton Fire Department, Hinton Ambulance, and Merrill Ambulance at the scene of the accident. All righty, we're going to continue on. Last night was the Emmy Awards. Schitt's Creek rises. Canadian comedy sweeps category. Succession Watchmen win big. Schitt's Creek, the little Canadian show about a fish-out-of-water family, made history at Sunday's Emmy Awards with a comedy awards sweep, something even TV greats including Frasier and Modern Family failed to achieve. Zendaya, 24, became the youngest lead drama actress winner for her role as a troubled teenager in Euphoria. Succession, a family power struggle over a media empire, was honored as best drama series. Succession star Jeremy Strong won the Dramatic Actor Trophy for his role of an aspiring heir. The awards for Pop TV's Schitt's Creek included Best Comedy Series and trophies for its stars, including Catherine O'Hara and father-son Eugene and Daniel Levy. It's absolutely incredible. I think my dad said it earlier this evening. It's a dream you don't want to wake up from, to be honest. What an absolutely unbelievable way to end our series, said Daniel Levy. In his acceptance speech, he said the sitcom was about the transformational effects of love and acceptance and is now something we need more than ever before, encouraging people to register to vote to achieve that goal. Other winners, including Watchmen star Regina King, made a point that the general election on November 3rd was near. All the winners accepted their awards virtually in the pandemic-safe ceremony, including O'Hara, but she wasn't alone. Though these are the strangest of days, you may have as much joy being holed up in a room or two with your family as I've had with my dear roses, O'Hara said, surrounded in a decorated room of mask-wearing co-stars who play the Rose family members. Levy called it ironical that the straightest role I ever played lands me an Emmy for a comedy performance. I have to seriously question what I've been doing for the past 50 years. Moments later, his son won the award for comedy writing for Schitt's Creek episode, then shared a directing award and captured the supporting actor comedy trophy. The supporting actress trophy went to his co-star Annie Murray. Daniel Levy thanked his father and O'Hara for teaching an extended masterclass in comedy. The show's sweep came for its much-acclaimed final season. And so on and so forth. Okay, let's move now to the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I do want to say also that I believe there are not any obituaries today, so I'll just continue on. In Washington, D.C., she was seeing family, she was exercising, listening to opera, doing the work of the court, she even officiated at a wedding. That's how Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg spent the weeks before her death Friday at 87. Those who had been in touch with Ginsburg or her staff recently said she seemed to be coping with treatment for cancer and also making plans for events months away. So the announcement of her death came as somewhat of a surprise, even to close friends. Mary Hartnett, one of the two authorized biographers, visited Ginsburg in mid-August at her longtime home in the Watergate apartment complex next to the JFK Center for Performing Arts in Washington. She said Ginsburg was plowing ahead despite a cancer reoccurrence. She was trying very hard to treat this, and essentially her body just gave out. Hartnett, who wore a mask and tested negative for the coronavirus before visiting, said the judge was continuing to do court work. She exercised, working out on a treadmill or using a tape made by a longtime trainer, Bryant Johnson. In the evenings, she would watch Live at the Met operas. Hartnett said she asked the justice whether there were any silver linings to her illness and the coronavirus pandemic. She said, oh, yes. She immediately lit up and said, yes, I've had so much time with my family, and they've been wonderful. Ginsburg announced in mid-July that she was receiving chemotherapy treatments, a fifth time that she's dealt with cancer since 1999. I have often said I would remain a member of the court as long as I could do the job full steam. I remain fully able to do that, Ginsburg said at the time. But it was hard for the public to gauge how sick Ginsburg was. She started receiving chemotherapy in May, 4 months before she revealed it publicly, and at a time of year when the justices typically take the bench at least a week to announce decisions. But because of the coronavirus, the justices were hearing arguments by telephone and out of the public eye.
In late August,
one photo of her became public. It was a joyous image, Ginsburg wearing a black and white embroidered collar and black judicial robes as she presided over an outdoor wedding in the Washington area. The picture was from August 30th, which was posted on Bride Barb's socialist Twitter account, suggested that Ginsburg was soldiering on. Soldish did not respond to emails from the AP requesting comment. Also this summer, Ginsburg would have been engaged in the work of the court. The justices handle some emergency matters over the summer, and Ginsburg would have also been preparing for the extended private conferences of judges at the end of September and before the start of the term in October.
Betsy West and Julie Cohen, who co-directed the 2008 documentary RBG about Ginsburg's life, said they got an email from her in mid-August, signed in her typical fashion, RBG. But on Friday, longtime friend Nina Apple got a call from Ginsburg's son, James. He told her that his mother had died just before sundown. He did not want her to hear the news first on TV, and she said she was grateful for the call. The court said she died surrounded by family at her home in Washington. Appel, the former dean of Loyola University Chicago's law school, who was friends with Ginsburg for over 60 years, said the news was a terrible shock and caught her off guard. She said she would remember her friend, not only as a brilliant jurist, but also as someone who connected with young people. She was always herself. She didn't pretend to be anything other than who she was. Ann Claire Williams, a former federal appeals court judge and Ginsburg's friend, said she had been in touch with Ginsburg's office over the summer to reschedule a public talk they had planned for the fall and pushed off to 2021. As recently as, say, 2 months ago, she was looking ahead to next year. Even though we knew she was ill, we didn't expect it to come to an end at this point. The day before she died, Ginsburg was honored by the National Constitution Center with its Liberty Medal. The center's president, Jeffrey Rosen, said in the opening to the video ceremony that Ginsburg was watching at home. The nearly hour-long video included some of Ginsburg's favorite opera singers and celebrity friends who addressed her directly. Ginsburg sent a note to the center made public. It closed by sending bravissimos to the participants in this event and all in attendance for lifting my spirits sky high.
Continuing on, Biden set to air first Iowa Network ads. Joe Biden's presidential campaign this week will be advertising on Iowa Network television stations for the first time. The Biden campaign previously has advertised in Iowa on cable channels and streaming services. The new ad campaign will feature a myriad ads on a variety of topics. Will begin on Tuesday in Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, Quad Cities, Sioux City, and Ottumwa markets, according to the Biden campaign. We're going to continue on. Siouxland Recovery Fund announces grants. The Siouxland Recovery Fund announced Tuesday that it has awarded more than $535,000 to local nonprofit organizations that have served Siouxland residents during the COVID-19 pandemic. Programs awarded funding include those providing food, mental health services, transition services, financial support, and more. Thanks to the Siouxland Recovery Fund for allowing us the opportunity to provide the health services for the Siouxland community, said Sheila Martin, CEO of Siouxland Mental Health Center. Telehealth allows patients to continue their mental health treatment while limiting exposure and not experiencing disruptions in care. The Siouxland Recovery Fund was activated on March 19th in response to the COVID-19 crisis. The purpose of the fund was to accept private donations and provide financial resources to help meet short-term needs for recovery in Siouxland. United Way of Siouxland serves as the fiscal agent of the Recovery Fund. The impact of the Siouxland Recovery Fund would not be possible without the generous support received from local, regional, and national donors.
we continue to hear stories of families who have never needed to ask for help, now relying on these programs. Our community has truly rallied together to make a difference during this time. And these were the comments of Heather Hennings of the United Way of Siouxland president. Grants awarded by the Siouxland Recovery Fund to date are $14,000 to Bishop Heelan Catholic Schools for their school learning connections, Boys and Girls Club of Siouxland delivering food to club members and families, $3,000. $23,000 to the Boys and Girls Club of Siouxland rebuilding summer financial losses. $5,000 to the Boys and Girls Home for emergency food assistance. $25,000 to Camp High Hopes for a fall weekend respite camp. $14,000 for the Center for Siouxland for disaster response and recovery. $7,000 to the Community Action Agency for personal protection equipment. Also to the Community Action Agency for their new website to increase access, another $5,000. Dakota County Voices for Food for a food security project secured $5,000. $50,000 to the Food Bank of Siouxland for their emergency food supplementation. Girls Inc. of Sioux City received $25,000 for full-day child care during the school year. $5,000 to the Growing Community Connections Dakota County. Heartland Counseling Services received $9,000 for group services post-COVID. And the list continues on and on to equate to $535,000 overall. All right, I'm going to continue to go on. Just a couple sports headlines. The Chicago Bears win. Trubisky throws 2 touchdowns. And the Giants, against the Giants, they won 17-13. However, Giants running back Saquon Barkley suffers potentially serious injury. Another exciting thing happened in the world of sports with the U.S. Open golf title going to Bryson DeChambeau, who was not the least bit concerned by the narrow fairways or the ankle-deep rough that shaped Wingfoot into historically the toughest of all U.S. Opens. DeChambeau has gained 40 extra pounds of muscle and mass, and he wanted to pound it into submission with his driver, even if his errant shots were buried into the deep grass. That's how he plays the game, and many skeptics said it wouldn't work at the U.S. Open at Wingfoot. Just look at him as he kisses the silver shiny trophy and the record score he posted Sunday in a 6-shot victory. The victory was about validation of his out-of-the-box approach to the royal and ancient game. 100% no doubt, for me it's been a journey of I can execute every shot more repeatable than everyone else. I was able to do that this week and I won by 6 strokes. The Kansas City Chiefs survive in an overtime. Butker's 58-yard field goal in overtime gives Kansas City the win in Hebert's debut. In prep volleyball, Heeling goes 3-2 at their own CYO tournament. Lots of football yesterday, and it continues on this evening. Think like a billionaire. This will be our last article. Words of advice and wisdom from Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is known as one of the best investors of all time, and he has amassed a multi-billion-dollar fortune investing through his company, Berkshire Hathaway. He's not only a great investor, he's also a great wit and enjoys sharing his folksy wisdom with fellow investors. His advice runs the gamut of topics, not only about investing, but about life in general. Today, let's stick to Buffett's advice that could help make you rich. Here is the surprising thing. Buffett's wisdom seems so common sense and practical, and yet it can lead to great wealth. Below are 7 of Buffett's most widely known wisdoms, and what they mean for investors. Number 1. Rule number 1 is never lose money. Rule number 2 is never forget rule number 1. Buffett's point sounds simple, but it's very complex. Of course, as an investor, you're trying to profit in the market, but one of the best ways to do that is avoiding loss. When you eliminate decisions that expose your portfolio to loss, that's what's left is more likely to be a gain. When you have more money in your portfolio, you can compound your gains even faster. This approach has implications for how you invest. Buffett's quote suggests that instead of looking for the highest upside, you should be looking to avoid loss first and then only look at gains. It's a different mindset for investors who view the stock market as a slot machine. Number two, opportunities come infrequently. When it rains gold, put out the bucket, not the thimble. Here, Buffett suggests that when you see an opportunity, you need to act quickly and decisively. When the odds are stacked in your favor, such as when stock prices are down, you need to invest heavily because good prices might not come along again soon. Buffett often takes this approach when markets are down significantly. He amasses a ton of cash during the good times and then invests aggressively when stocks plunge. Having a lot of safe cash on hand allows him to use this strategy. Number three, we simply attempt to be fearful when others are greedy, and be greedy only when others are fearful. While some investors think investing is a lot about the numbers, Buffett suggests that investing has as much to do with the behavior of investors themselves. When investors are greedy and push the price of stocks to the sky, Buffett becomes fearful because a market plunge may soon follow. In contrast, when investors run away from the market or a specific stock, Buffett becomes more interested because prices are cheaper. When stocks are cheaper, they don't have the same risk as when they're expensive. And that is how Buffett thinks about avoiding losses. In early 2020, the market plunged as worries about the coronavirus rattled investors. However, some investors dove into the market amid the fear, and the market rallied furiously off its lows. Number four, it's far better to buy a wonderful company at a fair price than a fair company at a wonderful price. While some value investors focus on buying only the cheapest companies, Buffett suggests a better course of action is to buy wonderful companies, those with better economics and competitive positions. Part of the difficulty here is whereas fair companies may go on sale relatively frequently, the great companies rarely look cheap. But a company with a good competitive advantage will likely continue to make money over time, and it can bail you out if you purchase at a too high price. That may not be the case for a fair company, which may falter and never return your purchase price or beyond. Number five, the most important quality for an investor is temperament, not intellect. You need a temperament that neither derives great pleasure from being with the crowd or against the crowd. Here again, Buffett touches on the value of temperament for a successful investor rather than intelligence. Rather than trying to go with or against the crowd, investors should analyze what's going on in the market, regardless of who likes what stock. By focusing on the objective facts, investors can make decisions that are relatively free of emotion and make better choices. The stock market, number six, the stock market is a no-called strike game. You don't have to swing at everything. You can wait for your pitch. This quote is one of Buffett's most famous, and it offers the essence of picking your opportunity. You needn't invest until you find an opportunity you find attractive, one that meets your standards of potential rewards for the risks you're taking. Number seven, if you're spending 6 to 8 hours per week working on investments, do it. If you don't, then dollar cost averaging into index funds. Buffett has long advised most investors to use index funds to invest in the market rather than trying to pick individual stocks. By picking individual stocks, you're working against the pros who have extensive intelligence on companies. In contrast, if you buy an index fund based on the S&P, you'll own the market, the target that everyone is aiming to beat. By all means, if you enjoy investing, then do it. But most investors are going to be well served by using index funds, and especially by avoiding trading in and out of stocks. Another advantage of using index funds is immediate diversification, which lessens your risk. So those are words of wisdom from the great Warren Buffett. This brings us to the end of the reading of today's Sioux City Journal. Today is Monday, September 21st. It looks like it's going to be a warm and sunny week. I hope that you enjoy your week ahead. Be safe, be careful,
And I will see you again next week. Thank you for joining us on the reading of the Sioux City Journal on Iris Radio.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa, and the first article we're going to read from the book is entitled Exploring Iowa. Located in the heart of America, Iowa is the land between two rivers, a region of the Midwest distinguished by a surprisingly rich, diverse cultural and culinary history. Between the forests of the eastern United States and the grasslands of the Great Plains to the west, Iowa's gently rolling landscape extends westward from the Mississippi River, which forms the state's entire eastern border. The Missouri River forms the western border, making Iowa the only U.S. state with two parallel rivers defining its borders. Rivers were the early highways, bringing explorers, trappers, traders, and settlers to the Iowa prairie. Centuries before the Europeans arrived, however, various Native American tribes, including the Sac, Fox, Sioux, Iowa, Meskwaki, and others, lived, hunted, and farmed across the region. The meaning of the name Iowa depends on who you ask. Traditionally, it has been described as an Iowa word, meaning the beautiful land, although others say that Iowa itself is the French spelling of Ayuwawa, a name meaning sleepy ones, a name given in jest to the Iowa tribe by the Dakota Sioux. Living off the land defined the food and farming traditions of the tribes like the Iowa, whose history is carefully recreated at Living History Farms in Urbandale. Iowa farmers raised corn, beans, melons, and squash. Women did the farming in the Iowa culture, while men were responsible for hunting and making tools. Iowa families were subsistence farmers, raising just enough for their family to survive throughout the year, and having a little put away in case of a bad year. The Iowa had separate summer, winter, and traveling lodges. Bark houses called nachachi kept the Iowa cool during hot summer months, while winter mat houses called chakiruta, made from layers of sewn cattail leaves, protected the Iowa from harsh winters and stayed around 50 degrees inside. While traveling on hunting expeditions, the Iowa lived in a chibo thraji, or teepee, made from buffalo hides. Their villages also contain sweat lodges, food drying racks, cooking areas, work areas, hide scraping rocks, pottery pits, and gardens. At Living History Farms, historical interpreters at the 1700 Iowa farm discuss hunting, hide processing, fur trading, tool making, gardening, food processing, and the roles that Iowa men and women played in each. Interpreters used both recreated bone and stone tools and reproduced trade items to perform daily tasks. By the era of the 1700 Iowa farm depicted at Living History Farms, the first Europeans had seen the land that would become Iowa. Had history taken a different course centuries ago, Iowans might be known for their unique brand of French cuisine with a distinctly Midwestern flair. In the late 1600s, European explorers began paddling up and down the Mississippi River, passing along Iowa's eastern border. The first to visit Iowa were Frenchmen. Louis Joliet led a crew accompanied by Father Marquette, a Catholic priest. In 1673, the expedition arrived in the area that includes Pikes Peak State Park near the Iowa town of McGregor. It would be almost 150 years after Marquette and Joliet sailed along Iowa's eastern border before white settlers began moving inland to farm Iowa's incredibly rich topsoil. In the meantime, trappers and traders began exploring the rivers that fed into the mighty Mississippi. The French established some trading posts that would grow into Midwestern cities, including St. Paul, Minnesota, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, and St. Louis, Missouri. In the 1780s, a young Frenchman named Julien Dubuque learned that there were rich deposits of lead ore on the west side of the Mississippi River near Prairie du Chien. Lead was valuable because it was used to make ammunition for guns and cannons. Dubuque lived among the Native Americans in the area and mined the ore. Dubuque set up lead mines near the location of the city that bears his name and lived in the area until he died in 1810. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.